You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Reflects the President's commitment to demonstrate that the United States will continue to play a leading role in this response. We certainly would like to see countries around the world do more.
Presidential spokesman Josh Earnest said the U.S. is doing its part to help address the growing humanitarian crisis. He also noted that the U.S. continues to be the largest donor of humanitarian financial aid. Some congressional Republicans are worried that ISIS fighters could get into the U.S. under the guise of being refugees. Over the weekend, Secretary of State John Kerry said the number will increase to 85,000 next year and to 100,000 in 2017. Josh Earnest noted that the U.S. continues to be the largest donor of humanitarian financial aid.
The United States has now committed to provide more than $4.5 billion to help address the dire conditions inside Syria and for the more than 4 million Syrian refugees scattered across the region.
A Utah family is joining a lawsuit after their son got salmonella from eating tainted cucumbers. Megan Mills says her mind instantly went to the worst-case scenario with her son Charlie as his condition got worse over the course of a month.
What's this little boy's life going to be like in a month, in a year, in 10 years? That's pretty scary.
Over 400 people nationwide have gotten sick from eating cucumbers distributed by Andrew and Williamson Fresh Produce, including 30 in Utah alone. The company has since recalled their products and says they're taking responsibility to fix it. I'm Ron Taylor, and you're listening to USA Headline News.
This is Jeannie Aversa, CRPC, financial advisor at Patton Hyde & Associates. Do you have questions about your retirement, like will your money last throughout your lifetime? Will you have enough to live the life you want? And when will you be able to retire? If so, you're not alone. As a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., Patton Hyde & Associates can help you find the answers with the exclusive Confident Retirement approach. We'll work with you one-to-one to understand your goals and discuss the four key areas of retirement, including covering your essentials, lifestyle, protection, and legacy needs. From there, we'll work together to develop a retirement roadmap with clear steps you can take to help you retire on your terms. Call Patton Hyde & Associates today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. The Confident Retirement approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor.
I'm your host, Chris Bianco. I'm the principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Blue Panther Business Partners offers practical advice and hands-on assistance to the business owner who never has time to improve his or her business. We do that by accomplishing your wish list. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technologies that consumers seeking solutions for personal or business use can be better informed when making purchasing decisions or hiring individuals to carry out those technological decisions. Each week, I will focus on topics about technology. Segments will include technology news, the latest apps, buying advice for hardware and software, and answering your questions. To contact me during the show, go to Tech Today on Facebook. You can email me at goodmorning@huntertonchamberradio.com. Phone number here in the studio, 908-237-0410. And to contact me outside of the show, BluePantherBIZ.com is my company website. Well, here we are. It's another Tuesday, and Apple has done their product release, informational release, and they've also working on a new operating system, iOS 9, and it's dominating the news. So we need to get you some information about all this. Very interesting, because for those that used to think that Apple was impervious, it's not anymore. Here's what's going on. From Reuters on Yahoo.com, published on the 18th, it says, Apple customers report devices crashing on an iOS 9 update. So Heather Somerville and Jane Wardle reported that a significant number of Apple customers are reporting their mobile devices have crashed after attempting to upload the new iOS 9 operating system, the latest in a line of launch glitches for the tech giant. Twitter and other social media were awash with disgruntled customers reporting two distinct faults, with one appearing to be linked specifically to older models of Apple iPhones and iPads. Quote, it is beyond inconvenient to not be able to use your iPhone for a day, said student Pip Cordy, as staff in the Apple store in Central Sydney looked at their phone on Friday. I have a lot of apps that I use for school, things like language apps and dictionaries, and that's all really important for my studies. Another iPhone user, Zori Coates, said she had spent 3 hours in the Apple store and had been left with an option of either returning her phone to factory settings, losing any non-backed-up data, or waiting until Apple technicians announced an update. Quote, they said they were aware of the problem and their engineers were working on it 24/7, but they couldn't tell me when or how I would get a solution, Zori said. I am very annoyed because it's wasted half my day. They pride themselves on being a company that's flawless. Apple's headquarters in San Francisco did not respond to a request for a comment late Thursday, and Apple spokesman in Sydney said the company had no comment. Despite any troubles, significant numbers of iOS users had upgraded, more than 16%, according to Mixpanel, a San Francisco, California-based analytics company, as of 4 p.m. on Thursday. Charlie Brown, a technology expert at Sydney-based CyberShack, said any number of dissatisfied customers was significant in the social media era, particularly following the troubled rollout of iOS 8. Apple released several further updates in iOS 8, but some of the bugs were never fully fixed. Welcome to the world of Microsoft, Apple. The risk to Apple in terms of having dissatisfied customers is that as their customers' base grows, so will the number of those dissatisfied customers, said Brown. One group of users reported that iOS 9 upgrade would fail after several minutes, requiring them to start the process over. Many posted screenshots of the error message they received, which, quoted, said, software update failed. Oh, another very informative message. That problem was likely caused by servers that were overloaded when too many people tried to download the upgrade simultaneously, tech analysts said. So now you understand why Microsoft was rolling out Windows 10 in a stepwise fashion. Quote, it's like the Black Friday thing, said Bob O'Donnell of Technalysis Research, referring to the major U.S. shopping sale day after Thanksgiving. Some websites get creamed on the traffic on Black Friday. Other users, many of them with older devices, reported their devices seizing up on a swipe-to-upgrade page. The latest upgrade had been deemed by Apple as, quote, friendly to the older devices after the iOS 8 problems. Apple were saying the downloading mechanism doesn't take as much space to download, said Sydney-based Graham McKay, who's an IT support analyst. McKay and Brown said that they always advise clients to wait several days before downloading any new upgrades from Apple, Google Inc., or Microsoft to make sure that any glitches had been found and ironed out. Metering the upgrade or allowing users to upgrade in waves rather than all at once would have been a smarter approach, O'Donnell said. It's a lot about setting expectations, he said. Apple did this week delay the release of Watch OS 2, its updated operating system for the Apple Watch, after discovering a bug in development. Well, Apple customers, loyal Apple customers, welcome to the rest of the development world. Don't know what's happening over there at Apple, but it appears that now Apple is starting to feel the same wrath that Microsoft customers feel when they are looking to upgrade. Very interesting. We move on to another Apple announcement and news article from ZDNet. It says, hackers can't easily get malware directly in iOS apps, so they're taking a different approach, modifying the programming environment that Apple provided to make apps. Uh-oh. So here, think about this for a minute. Apple was very restrictive for years about how they wanted to keep their operating system code closed so that outside sources, external sources, were not developing outside apps. The customer base demanded that more outside apps get developed because Apple couldn't keep up with the demand. So now they open up the API, and all, lo and behold, now we have the possibility of hacks going on. So let's see what's really happening and see if it's not extreme. So Google's open approach to Android apps have led to several malware issues over the past few years, while Apple users have remained relatively unscathed. Not anymore. At least 39 apps installed by several hundred million iPad and iPhone owners include malware, according to Forbes. The initial issue report came from Palo Alto Networks last week, noting that hackers took a unique approach to inject malware into iOS apps. Since a challenge to get malware past Apple's App Store review team, hackers took a more indirect way by adding the rogue code into what app developers thought was the official Apple version of Xcode, Apple's IDE for several iOS and Mac OS X apps. Developers should be downloading Xcode directly from Apple, but the toolset is often mirrored on third-party sites, and the development tools on those sites looks like Xcode, hence the name Xcode Ghost for the software. However, the programming environment has some minor changes to get the malware into apps created with it, unbeknownst to the developers. Known infected apps include WeChat, PDF Reader, WinZip, Pocket Scanner, Camcard, and many other China-specific titles. Palo Alto Networks says it is working with Apple to help mitigate the issue. The malware-infected apps can find and send specific data about the device and are searching to access iCloud cloud credentials. Apple's app review process and developer toolset have generally been solid in preventing such malware issues, far better than Google Android users have been regardless. Determined hackers have found a hole to exploit iOS apps, and Apple needs to plug it. First step may be for the company to validate if developers have a legitimate copy of Xcode to begin the bin with. Meanwhile, in a statement on its WeChat blog, Tencent says it has a new WeChat version for iOS that doesn't have the malware, suggesting users upgrade their app immediately. So some fallback to try and get those apps corrected because they brought that rogue code to our iPhones and our iPads. Moving on from there, here's another Apple. Your home could become one giant iPhone, courtesy of Apple, says the Business Insider, Lisa Edicio, yesterday on Yahoo Finance. So, Apple's Craig Federighi unveils HomeKit. Last year, Apple announced a technology that will let you control the appliances in your home with Siri. It's called HomeKit, and after Apple plans work out, it will turn your home into one giant computer like the iPhone, but everywhere. The iPhone, like any other computer, is a piece of hardware built by a certain company that can run apps and play games built by other companies and developers all over the world. These apps expand the functionality and usability of your phone. If you could only use these apps made by Apple on your iPhone, imagine how limiting the experience would be. Apple is opening up similar opportunities with HomeKit by allowing developers to build new features and apps that run your home. The HomeKit version, in most basic terms, is a language that allows internet-connected appliances to speak to one another in your home. For instance, if the HomeKit-enabled light in your kitchen turns on, that might tell the HomeKit-connected coffee pot to kick on and start brewing the first pot of coffee for the day. Or perhaps your smart door lock would trigger the lights in your bedroom to turn on as soon as you walk through the door. There are also smart plugs that work with HomeKit, which turn any normal home appliance into a smart device. Plugging a lamp, an air conditioner, or even a home appliance into one of these plugs allows you to control it with your phone or with your voice using Siri. HomeKit also has something called Scenes, preset scenarios that make it easier to control a group of HomeKit devices all at once. For instance, a leaving home scene might turn off all of your HomeKit gadgets at once, or a going to bed scene might tell the lamp plugged into your HomeKit enabled plug to turn off while telling the HomeKit connected thermostat to make the temperature more comfortable for sleeping. The clever part, you don't need to make the actual appliances or hardware to make an app for HomeKit. Anybody could theoretically create an app that makes a Philips Hue light bulb act a certain way when a certain song or TV show is on. This scenario depends on some cooperation with the hardware makers. In this case, Philips would have to open up its light bulb to the HomeKit community. But in general, Apple wants third parties to be able to build their own apps and features for HomeKit devices. It's a near repeat of what Apple did with the iPhone. When it first came out in 2007, it only included pre-bundled apps from Apple. A year later, Apple opened it up to app makers and created the App Store, and the rest is history. Opening HomeKit to the broad community of app makers has its pros and cons. According to Chris Allen, the CEO of iDevices, which makes smart plugs and thermostats that work with HomeKit, it's a double-edged sword, Allen said to Business Insider. The fact that companies can take my product and do something with it that I don't control, that scares me. There's a fear factor associated with that, and we're working through it. But ultimately, Allen expects this openness to lead to better apps, since it gives talented software developers who understand interface design the chance to make apps for the gadgets in your home. What I think Apple was trying to do, Allen says, is take app developers that maybe created great gaming apps and other apps and bring that experience into HomeKit. The trick is getting the app makers involved, not just the hardware companies, agrees Dr. Marcus Fest, CEO of Elgato, which makes a HomeKit-connected sensor called Eve that measures air quality, temperature, and more. There's a great opportunity for software-focused guys to come out and make an app that blows everyone out of the water, Fest told us. Both Fest and Allen pointed out the apps made by hardware manufacturers often don't have the greatest design. With HomeKit, third parties can step in and add design flourishes that make those products easier and more fun. For instance, clever software makers could add an icon such as a pinwheel to control the temperature in your home, or let you control the temperature with the digital crown on your Apple Watch. Any developers building apps for HomeKit have to use the same safety guidelines as the device makers themselves. This means they need clear, overt privacy practices and must follow Apple's guidelines to gain access to the data about your home. Although internet-connected home appliances aren't widespread yet, adoption is set to take off this year, according to research from Parks Association. According to the firm, 40% of broadband households in the U.S. are planning to buy a smart home device in 2015, compared to the 16% of households that have them now. One reason why these devices are rare, they're often difficult to set up. There's been a little bit of block-in. How hard is this? What does it take to set up? Mike Tamillo, Senior Vice President of General Merchandising at Lowe's, said to Business Insider. With HomeKit, Apple made a strong effort to fix this problem. All HomeKit devices, regardless of which manufacturer has made them, offer the same setup steps so that the experience is consistent. You would simply download the necessary company's app required for your device to begin and setup process, which requires inputting the setup code on your gadget. This is even easier in iOS 9, since you can scan the setup code with your iPhone's camera rather than typing it in. This prompts a device to quickly and securely pair to the iPhone, and HomeKit scenes are also consistent no matter which device you're using. So you could have an iDevices plug or an Ecobee thermostat, and they'd all work the same way with the leaving home scene you set up. Those scenes are easy to set up from your iPhone and iPad as well. Wow, lots of great stuff going on there. So excited to hear about it. But you have to realize there's a caveat, right? The caveat is you just heard about the other two articles where We're opening it up to developers because we want to get third-party developers to start developing. And now you started to learn how it's hard for the developers to get stuff into the Apple Store. It's going to be equally as hard for developers to get it into the HomeKit Store. And, oh, by the way, we just heard about how the iOS 9 has its bugs, and we just heard about how the iOS Xcode has malware injected into it. So Apple's got to be more vigilant with regard to its own product and product infrastructure before the third parties start getting involved, or this will be a huge bomb if it doesn't work right. A lot of loyalists out there, and so I'm sure it'll take off at some point, but it's going to be interesting to see how it all works together. We're at that point to take a break, do a station ID. We'll be back with more of Tech Today on HuntingChamber.com in a moment. Let Stowaway Self-Storage be your local moving and storage solution. With three great locations in Hunterdon County, Stowaway is conveniently located in Flemington, White House, and Lebanon. Stowaway Self-Storage offers sizes from 5x5 to 50x50, discounted packing supplies, and U-Haul rentals on site. Affordable monthly rentals for your personal and business use, let Stowaway help you park your car in the garage again or store those old records that you need to keep. Visit us at stowawayselfstorage.com and mention this ad to receive 50% off your first month's rent. Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntingChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunterdon Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunterdon Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live, or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntingChamberRadio.com app today.
Hi, I'm Sharon Skibbe of CompuPay Payroll. The Chamber is a great way to connect to other businesses within Hunterdon County and build strong and lasting business relationships.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, ceremony officiant with CelebrationOfALifetime.com. I joined the Chamber so I can get to know you and what you're all about, and I hope you want to get to know me and what I'm all about. Then we can celebrate what we can do to make Hunterdon County better.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntingChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunterdon Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunterdon Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live, or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntingChamberRadio.com app today.
If you're looking to get in front of thousands of new customers, connect with your current customers, you don't want to miss out on the largest business show in Hunterdon County. The 27th annual Hunterdon County Business and Home Expo, coming up on a new date, Thursday, November 5th, in a new location at Hunterdon Central High School in Flemington at the Fieldhouse in Common from 2 to 7 p.m. You surely want to sign up. You surely want to exhibit. Something you don't want to miss. Contact the Chamber at 908-782-7115 or visit our website at HuntingChamber.org.
Dominated the first quarter of my show all about Apple, and it still continues. But what it's going to talk about now is there's an app that perhaps you stumbled upon in the Apple Store that made you quite happy, and it was a developer who pulled it, leading ad blocking app from Apple Store. Jessica Tunkel reported via Reuters on September 18th. Can't speak today. Yahoo News, and she says Tumblr co-founder Marco Arment, who developed the most popular paid ad blocker on Apple Inc.'s U.S. App Store, has pulled the product, citing concerns that the tool could hurt independent web publishers. In a blog post on Friday, Arment wrote that he was pulling his Peace app because he does not feel that it is his role to decide what content is blocked. Quote, ad blockers come with an important asterisk. While they do benefit a ton of people in major ways, they also hurt some, including many, who don't deserve the hit, Arment wrote. Interesting perspective. Arment did not respond to an email and call requesting comment. The controversy around ad blocking software kicked up his week after Apple made it available on the new version of the iPhone operating system on Wednesday. Arment's $2.99 ad blocking app, Peace, was the number one paid app in the United States over the past 2 days, according to Arment's blog. According to Apptopia, Inc., a Boston-based company that tracks App Store downloads and revenue, the Peace app generated $113,521 in gross proceeds in the 36 hours it was live. Even though I'm winning, I've enjoyed none of it, Arment wrote in his blog. That's why I'm withdrawing from the market. Ad-blocking tools are designed to help web pages load much faster by stripping out so-called scripts and trackers that are used to serve the ads. However, many argue that such tools hurt publishers, particularly smaller ones, by forcing them to develop dedicated iPhone apps rather than relying on mobile-friendly websites. Some have even suggested that such apps amounts to theft that will all be destroy the web as we know it. Ad-blocking hurts publishers, prevents businesses from communicating and competing, reduces the diversity of voices in digital media, and hinders consumers from obtaining important information about products, services, even politics and culture. That was written by Randall Rothenberg, president and CEO of the Interactive Advertising Bureau. In an emailed statement, he said, all it does is empower the biggest companies, which are the only ones that can afford to end run the roadblocks and toll gates. Some 20 million people used ad blockers this year, up 40% from a year earlier, resulting in $22 billion in lost advertising revenue, according to a study by Adobe and Pagefair, an anti-ad blocking tech company. As of Friday afternoon, two other ad blockers were the number one and number four most popular apps in the U.S. App Store. So it's interesting what Mr. Arment is referring to is that the web is a mature business model nowadays. There's a lot of complexity with how the balance of a user's experience versus the free, quote-unquote, free use of the Internet and the free use of information and data being paid for by ads. And yet we're looking for another program, paid or not, to block those ads. And yet it's kind of like the argument about billboards. You know, the billboards are on the roads, but we don't really want to pay for the roads. Then we complain about the toll booths, right? The Garden State Parkway, the bridges, the turnpike, we have to pay for those. Either they're going to come through our taxes or they're going to come directly from our source of revenue, from us, because we're using the roads. Different business model. Well, the Internet has both, and a lot of people enjoy. And certainly we want to have people enjoy the freedom of the Internet, but the Internet has to be paid for somehow, some way. The commerce to deliver that free content has to be paid for some way. People are not doing it for free. And yet, the way it's done is if you're not paying for it directly, like riding on the turnpike, somebody's got to pay for it, and that's ads. And so if you don't want to see the ads, now you're willing to pay for an ad blocker. Well, that's not what the design was for the people who were writing, who were giving you that free content in the first place. The contract with the person who's giving you that free content was that it was going to be paid for by ads of businesses that want to get to you as a consumer. So you have to allow that commerce to go. That's why it's a complex business model. So it's interesting to see how this all plays out. All right. I think we've successfully taken over all of the Apple world now, and we can start moving on to talk about other things. Oh, about 8 years ago, there was a, it's still out there, I think. It's called Second Life. There was a game. It was actually a virtual reality. And what I found fascinating, because I went into the virtual reality world of Second Life to learn how it worked, and I had learned that IBM saw that as an opportunity for a way of recruiting new, back then I guess it was Generation Y, employees, potential employees. Now, without taking too much time, let me explain that Second Life was a virtual reality in that you lived a completely different life in a computer. You had relationships. You could sell goods and services. You could roller skate. You could buy a car. And some people lived in that thing almost their entire lives. Rather than living the life in our dimension, they were living it in Second Life, and somehow, some way, IBM and a couple other large corporations saw it as an opportunity to innovatively reach employees by literally interviewing people in the world of Second Life for the sake of dragging them out of Second Life and making them an employee in our dimension. So let me just stop there for a second. So here we go now with a new innovation. And the new innovation is the world of Snapchat. And Goldman Sachs is tapping Snapchat for recruiting because it's where our millennials are today. So Reuters, Angela Moon, and Tariro Mabziwa reported on the 18th that in its latest push to broaden its allure among millennials, Goldman Sachs Group rolled out a series of quick-hit recruiting ads on Snapchat on Friday, becoming the first major Wall Street bank to run to the instant but fleeting messaging app for potential hires. The ads appear on Snapchat's campus story function, a curated platform for user-generated content such as pictures and videos at college campuses nationwide. Goldman's 10-second recruitment clips appear between user-generated content segments. In the videos, Goldman says it's seeking a campus environmental leader, youth sports coach, or crowdfunding champion and provides a link to gs.com/campus. Only Snapchatters whose phones indicate they are in and around a campus or were there in the last 24 hours are able to post to and view the campus story. Goldman's efforts to reach out to millennials comes amidst mounting indications that careers in banking and finance hold a diminishing appeal among recent graduates. Even at elite business programs like Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Harvard Business School, and University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, the percentage of students opting for banking as a career is down by half or more since before the recession. The move is the latest leg of Goldman's bid to appeal to soon-to-be college grads and push back against the prevalent view of investment banking as an all-work and no-play career. In June, the investment bank told its summer interns they should be out of the office between the hours of midnight and 7 a.m. during the week, seeking to curb excessive hours worked by young employees who see internships and entry-level jobs as a chance for a lucrative investment banking career. Goldman is also one of the few in the industry adding employees now. During the bank's second quarter earnings call, Goldman said its workforce grew 8% over the last four quarters and rose 1% between March 31st and June 30th. At the end of June, the bank had 34,900 employees. Snapchat, which allows its more than 100 million users to send messages that disappear in seconds, is considered one of the Silicon Valley's most highly valued startups. As of May, the messaging app is worth $16 billion. So there you go, an example of innovation in how a stodgy old Wall Street company is starting to try and connect with the next generation of employees. Got to do it differently, and Goldman Sachs is trying to do that. So as I continue to report to you about the latest apps, trends, and technology, The question is, are you going to do it the old-fashioned way, even though the old-fashioned way was only 10 years ago or even 5 years ago? Or are you going to be more innovative and creative and try and reach your new employees or your new customers through the apps and the software and the technology that they use? That's a question of life and death as far as a business is concerned. And now Goldman Sachs, who has been in the news for a lot of other things, is now starting to demonstrate an innovation, an innovative side to them to move ahead in reaching their new generation of employees. Fascinating. Moving on from there, how about we were talking about virtual reality. Wired reports on a virtual reality game that is as scary as a horror game. And it was written by Chris Kohler in Entertainment on the 20th of September. And he says, on the surface, the two PlayStation VR games on display at Sony's Tokyo Game Show booth couldn't be any more different. One is a horror scenario that drops you into a gruesome, terrifying predicament. The other puts you on a beautiful seaside next to an attractive young lady. But after playing both, Chris said, I couldn't shake the feeling that I'd played the same demo twice. The sheer intimacy of these experiences, the feeling of having one's personal space invaded, if you will, was unmistakable, and I can still feel it now at a distance. A long line stretches to the back of Sony's Tokyo Game Show stand, people patiently waiting their turn on the 20 or so demo stations of the PlayStation VR, which is called Project Morpheus. Sony's upcoming virtual reality headset for PlayStation 4. There were many different demos, but those that left the deepest impression on me were Capcom's horror demo, Kitchen, and Bandai Namco's romance sim, Summer Lesson. I'd already had a lurking horror experience with Alien Isolation on Oculus Rift that caused me to seriously contemplate ripping the VR headset off my head midway through. I didn't. But when Kitchen started, I felt like maybe this was the first time I finally did. I awoke with my hands bound together. In real life, I was holding a PlayStation controller, which of course placed my hands close together, a nice touch. In a dingy room, a man next to me was screaming in my face, telling me we had to get out. We did not, because some kind of female ghoul entered the room and killed that guy, but not me. She was all up in my face, very close. My reaction to the fake scary things I have discovered by going to a few of those crazy haunted houses is to laugh nervously. I was cracking up during Kitchen because Kitchen was some no-holds-barred scary stuff. At one point, I am ashamed to say, some part of the VR rig slipped down and tapped me on the shoulder, making me gasp quite loudly and reach around ready to kill whatever it was. Then the ghoul left the room, and nothing happened for a while. This was the scariest thing of all, because I knew something was going to jump out at me. But where? When? In a PlayStation VR demo, when there is of the essence, when time is of the essence, because you move people through as soon as possible. Sony let this go on for a while. Nothing had happened. Nothing. And I was riveted as I've ever been in a game. When I died, following another very up-close and personal encounter, from which I could not look away, it came as something of a relief. I didn't expect to feel similarly uncomfortable during Summer Lesson, the pitch for which is you are a teacher providing a private tutoring session to an attractive female student. Things started off fairly benign, with the student appearing and sitting down next to you, reading from a textbook. You could choose to teach English to a Japanese student in her bedroom or Japanese to an American student at a beach house. At one point, and this happens in either scenario, the student leans in very close and asks, Sensei, how do you read this word? Then she places the book in front of your face, leaning into you in what can only be described as an extremely intimate manner. My heart rate went up. The experience triggered the same alarms that would go off if I was a real-life stranger, got so close, and I could feel her breath. This goes on for a few minutes, with the student perhaps leaning over you to pick something up, or leaning in to whisper something in a hushed, conspiratorial tone. It's important to note that this is not about gawking at a virtual woman. Everyone involved is dressed entirely appropriate. There are no bikinis, no peaks up a skirt, nothing like that. This isn't salacious. but it is quite plainly erotic. It's supposed to be. The genius of Summer Lesson is how it illustrates the sheer power of virtual reality to not only transport you, but to create genuine emotional reactions so that you see. The women in Summer Lesson need not dress provocatively or talk about sex or do anything more than get slightly close than society convention typically allows. As in that long stretch of nothing in kitchen, there's tremendous power in the timeliness in the tiniest interactions. That underscores the counterintuitive truth that makes VR gaming so exciting. Despite its ability to hijack your senses and immerse you in hyperrealism, the real power of VR may lie in its ability to foster quiet intimacy so realistic it's unsettling. And wow, that gives you a lot of sense of where it can go. And you wonder whether there's going to be a moral side to that at some point. You don't know. All right, we're at the halfway point. We're going to need to take another break. We'll be back with more of Tech Today in just a few minutes. All right, we're back, and we're back to talking about Apple and iPhone again. I found another article that I definitely wanted to talk to you about, and it's one of the banes of the Apple iPhone existence, and that is trouble charging. And so here's an article from Yahoo Finance on here's a simple trick to fix your iPhone if it's having trouble charging. Business Insider Stephen Tweedy wrote this article on Sunday, and he says, we've all been there. I haven't, Stephen, because I don't use an iPhone. You plug your charger into your iPhone, but it doesn't seem to be recognizing the charger. Or if it does, moving your phone even slightly seems to cause it to disconnect and stop charging. I first ran into this problem a couple years ago with my iPhone 5. I noticed that my iPhone just wouldn't recognize my charger, and it got so bad that I would wrap my charging cable around my iPhone and attempt to keep it firmly in place. At first, I thought the problem was a bad charging cable, but after trying one of my roommate's cables to no avail, I began to suspect the issue was with the iPhone itself. Frustrated, I was able to schedule a Genius Bar appointment at an Apple store when my friend John told me he knew what the issue was. Pocket lint. You always keep your iPhone in your pocket, right? Said John, telling me he had experienced the same issue before. It was true. I did keep my iPhone in my pocket when I wasn't using it, and while it made sense that some pocket lint might build up in the iPhone's charging port, I was skeptical it could actually prevent it from charging. But after grabbing a paper clip and inserting it into my iPhone's charging port and digging around, I was surprised to see a large amount of pocket lint fall out. Much more than I expected. After all was said and done, a sizable amount of lint was left on my desk. I tried my charging cable again, and voila! My iPhone immediately recognized it and started to charge. I could even wiggle the charging cable around, and the connection stayed solid. It was fixed. 2 years later, my colleague Nathan told me that he had the same problem, so we tried the trick using a paperclip and found that the pocket lint was again the culprit. And here they show you stuff that came out, including a penny. And how about that? So the next time you notice your iPhone isn't charging properly, try to find a slim object that you can use to dig out any built-up pocket lint in your charging port. Over time, the pocket lint gets packed into the corners and the sides of the charging port, causing the connection between the charging port and the cable to be blocked. And lo and behold, something as simple as that is probably generating more business and more frustration than necessary. One of the interesting things about technology is sometimes the simplest answer and the most cost-effective answer is the one that we don't believe. And that's what Stephen was proving there. He didn't believe that it could be pocket lint, and lo and behold, it was. So sometimes you have to actually move away from technology solutions and just simply look at the simple picture. if you're putting your phone in your pocket, it doesn't matter whether it's an iPhone or an Android, there's a chance that you could be getting pocket lint in there. So very interesting. Moving on, how about this? Consumer Reports lets us know that iPhone upgrade program makes it easier to switch carriers. I think we've reported this from another article, but here Consumer Reports is verifying it and confirming it. Mike Gigas, Consumer Reports, reported on the 17th that if you're unhappy with AT&T or Sprint is treating you, just pick a new service provider when you choose a new iPhone. So much of the talk about Apple's new iPhone upgrade program has focused on the great pricing. And for gotta-have-it upgraders, it is a pretty good deal. About $30 to $45 per month, depending on the model, plus $129 spread out over 24 interest-free payments for Apple Care, which is among the few extended warranty programs we recommend for certain customers. By choosing the iPhone upgrade program, you can opt for a brand-new phone after a year or pay off the one you already have and treat yourself to a monthly savings. AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon confirmed to us that service costs will be the same for iPhone upgrade program devices as they are for models bought from the carriers themselves. Not bad. Even better, it's super easy to change carriers. That's because you're dealing with Apple for the phone and not the carrier. If you're fed up with spotty Sprint coverage in your area, bring the phone to AT&T. If you're not happy with Verizon prices, hello, T-Mobile. So long as you're not currently tied to a two-year carrier plan, you can pick up a new iPhone and new service provider while you're at it. So what's more, if you pay off the iPhone 6S or 6S Plus, you might even be able to bring your phone to another carrier. Here's why. Apple appears to be making only two versions of those phones. One seems to be compatible with the LTE networks of Sprint, T-Mobile, Verizon, and a vast number of international carriers. The other supports AT&T's LTE network, along with more than 30 smaller domestic carriers, including Boost, Consumer Cellular, Credo, Cricket, Net10, Straight Talk, and U.S. Cellular. Apple's site warns that LTE band support for the models listed will be based on whether those models are configured for CDMA networks, Sprint and Verizon, or GSM networks, which is AT&T and T-Mobile. Our engineers of Consumer Reports will be testing the phones for cross-carrier compatibility once they're available on September 25th. If it turns out that you can bring a Verizon phone to T-Mobile, how cool would that be? And that would be pretty cool. Very cool stuff. All right, so Apple continues to make it easier for us to change carriers, and they're taking it away. The funny thing is that the carriers are moving away from the installment plans, and now it looks like Apple is starting to implement the installment plans. It'll be interesting if Google and the Android manufacturers, Motorola and Nokia and all that, will do the same thing, Samsung. If they want to start doing installment plans and move away from the carriers as well, we might have a new disruption in the world of cell phones and smartphones in the near future. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be back with more of Tech Today right after these messages.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntingChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunterdon Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunterdon Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live, or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntingChamberRadio.com app today.
The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce is proud to present HuntingChamberRadio.com. All business, all talk, all community. Bringing you local news, information, events, and informative programming. Proudly serving the businesses and residents of Hunterdon County, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Pat Smits, Law Offices of Patricia Garrity Smits, LLC. The Hunterdon Chamber is a great resource to find the best local business people and meet new friends.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Surprisingly, my show is almost over, but I still have more information to get to you. Let's see what's also going on out there. I guess a little bit of futuristic thought is the final segment here. The first one is Robert Reich is totally wrong. Tech is the most competitive industry in the United States. Just to give you an idea of the cycle of technology and how it had started in the U.S., had been shipped off to emerging markets, and now seems to be coming back. Matt Rosoff on Business Insider and Yahoo Finance reports that Berkeley professor and economist Robert Reich argues in the New York Times that the big tech industry has become too powerful and suggests that more government intervention is necessary to stop giants like Google, Facebook, and Amazon from amassing more power. Anybody read the history of how the energy companies and the phone companies got into business? If you believe Reich, you'd have to argue that almost every other sector in the U.S. economy deserves even more government intervention, because, in fact, the tech industry, by which we're actually referring to information technology, not other kinds of tech like biotech, has been seen more turnover and power in a shorter amount of time than any other U.S. industry. Reich notes that Internet viewership is more concentrated now than it was 14 years ago. In 2001, 75% of all traffic goes to the top 10 websites, whereas 14 years ago it was 31%. But think about this. In 2001, the web as a mass market medium was only 6 years old. In the last 20 years, the medium that Reich is complaining about grew from literally nothing and became a competitor to old media sources that had been around for decades. When I was growing up in the mid-70s, there were three TV networks, three sources of TV news. All three of those networks had been around almost since the dawn of television, more than 20 years before. At the same time, every city had one morning newspaper, one source of print news, and those newspapers were decades old. One of the tricks of antitrust law, as Reich surely knows, is defining the relevant market. And yes, if you define online media as the relevant market, in the last 10 years there has absolutely been a concentration of power in the few big players, particularly Google and Facebook, which dominates web advertising and when people spend the most time. But if you define the relevant market as media, the number of powerful players today is far larger than it must have been before web started. Same with the commerce. If you define an e-commerce as its own market, yes, Amazon dominates. But if you define it as part of a larger retail sector, guess what? Amazon is a powerful counterweight to retail giants like Walmart, and it doesn't exist until 1994. Then there's this bizarre bit of Reich's column. The most valuable intellectual properties are platforms so widely used that everyone else has to use them, too. Think of standard operating systems like Microsoft Windows or Google's Android. That sentence fragment glosses over one of the hugest shifts in power in the annals of business. For a little more than 10 years, Microsoft did indeed have a monopoly on computer operating systems. In 2006, more than 90% of all computers connected to the Internet ran Microsoft Windows. Then Apple's iOS came out in 2007 and Android in 2008. As of 2014, Windows runs on only about 15% of computers, including tablets and smartphones connecting to the Internet. Before you bring up Microsoft, Microsoft's fall from dominance had little to do with the government's antitrust case, which was all about bounding a web browser from Windows to squash Netscape and playing nasty with hardware makers to force them to carry Microsoft software in lieu of competitor software.
That case was over and settled by 2007. What really caused the fall was unforeseen competition. Microsoft dominated the desktop PC market and didn't imagine that a smartphone operating system would even be good enough to replace PCs for most tasks, for most people and around the world. Reich is right. There are natural monopolies in tech. Everybody is using Google for search, so Google gets the most data about what people are searching or which makes its search and search ads more relevant. Everybody uses Facebook because everybody's on Facebook. But those monopolies are incredibly fragile. They are regularly disrupted when competitors redefine the playing field. Apple and Google didn't beat Microsoft by competing on the desktop. They did it by expanding the relevant market with something completely new. Absolutely right. And I think it's exponentially going faster. You can hear in the article how it was decades for certain things to happen, and now it's only taking, less than 10 years. And soon, I believe it's going to fall into almost a year-on basis. And then we'll be disrupted and move on to something, again, completely different. It's amazing to watch. It really is. And moving on to retail, speaking of it, five tools will personalize our e-commerce experience in 2016, says Inc.com. Our e-commerce experience could be either dull or fascinating, and these tools are trying to bridge the gap. So Yev Vilner, co-founder of Ranky, wrote this on Inc.com, and he says, despite the convenience of e-commerce, the industry is not exactly renowned for its excitement. More or less, e-commerce generally serves as a means to an end. Your customers need a product, they search for it online, and purchase it because it's the least expensive or most viable option. If a competing site had better products, better presentation, or is more convenient and interactive, they will win the customer's love again and again. But e-commerce has the potential to be so much more. With today's technology, we can infuse personality into the online shopping experience. WebbyClip. If it's no secret that the thrill that often comes with shopping is somewhat absent in the online variant. Though it's a great feeling to find products quickly and at the best value on the internet, there's no way to examine quality, functionality, and attractiveness as you can in person. For many shopaholics, not only does it take away the fun, but it also removes an essential part of a shopper's experience. And so WebbyClip brings personality and interaction back to online shopping by embedding engaging product videos at strategic points throughout the user's journey. WebbyClip's algorithm is able to identify and capture the most useful and captivating video for each product and show them to customers at optimum stages of the interest. While obviously the tool can't let the consumer see and feel the product themselves, they do get the next best thing, or perhaps even better, since they easily find practical information about the product in question in a manner that is fun, interactive, and personal. And then, let's face it, oftentimes the reason your customers love a particular store is because of what it represents and the type of people they attract. Stores such as Bloomingdale's and Walmart have spent years building their communities by trying to attract specific like-minded types of shoppers. Shopping is social by nature. Therefore, people crave that interaction and support when buying products. Spot.im gives online shoppers the community they are missing. Their new comments platform gives people the opportunity to ask questions to one another about products they are buying, their purchase experience, and more. This way, users are able to create their own conversations around their purchase in real time, as they would if they were shopping with a friend. Not only does it help to build engagement, but it also gives you brand a loyal group of followers for years to come. You wouldn't buy a skirt without asking your friends first if it looks good on you. Gretchen Wieners famously proclaims in the film Mean Girls, though this quote has not rung true with everyone, it is still relatable to many of your customers, as they may also need to get validation from friends prior to making a major purchase. This reassurance helps them verify they are making a good decision and help them to feel their buy is justified. Since friends are not always around when you browse online, this aspect is often missing from the e-commerce experience. That's where Loopit comes in. Loopit is an awesome product page tool which allows users to ask their friends their opinions on a product before they make a purchase. This way, they can get a reliable opinion.